Okay, so we'll start with three times homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. And today is April 5th, 2014. Maybe it's better if I stand. Okay, so today we'll be taking it's called the Chabbi Sodhana Sutta, which means the discourse on the sixfold purification or purity. And this is sutta number 112 in the Majjhima Nikaya, the Middle Age Discourses. And the theme of this discourse is how an arahat declares arahatship and how the monks are to question a monk who declares arahatship in order to see whether they can confirm his attainment. Okay, so the sutta begins when the Buddha is living in Jeta's Grove at Savatthi. And then after he calls the attention of the monks, then he says, "Here, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu makes a declaration of final knowledge." Now the word, the Pali word for final knowledge is anya. And this comes from the root nya, from which we get the verb janati, and it has a prefix a, which seems to strengthen the meaning of this word, of this root. And so you'd always in the text, or almost always, the word anya is taken to be an equivalent of arhatship. We could say it's the final knowledge that's attained by the arahat. And as you know, the arahat is the one who has reached the culmination of the practice and has attained what's called the final fruit or the highest fruit of the path. So he's one who has broken all of the bonds, cut off all of the fetters, and attained liberation from the cycle of birth and death. And so the way the declaration of arhatship comes down in the text, probably in actuality, different arhats would declare their attainment in different ways, but in order to make it simple to preserve these texts by oral transmission, the compilers use one particular formula as a declaration of final knowledge. And that is what is stated here, that when he declares final knowledge, he says, "I understand that birth is destroyed," or "birth is finished." And of course, for everybody, birth is finished. You know, from the second hour of one's life up to the time of one's death, one could say birth is finished. But this doesn't mean that birth is finished in that sense, that any two-hour-old baby is finished with birth. But rather what he means is that the bondage to rebirth is finished. In other words, that there's not going to be any more taking of birth within this cycle of samsara. So birth is finished. The holy life has been lived. The holy life here, or the brahmacharya, means the life of the Noble Eightfold Path. So what this means when he says that the holy life has been lived, that he's completed the development of the full Noble Eightfold Path, that all of the eight factors of the path have reached their culmination. And so then to express that in a different way, he says, what had to be done has been done. And the commentaries give an interesting explanation of this phrase, what had to be done has been done. And they relate this to the Four Noble Truths. Now, if you remember the first discourse of the Buddha, the turning or setting in motion of the wheel of the Dharma, the Buddha says with regard to each of the Four Noble Truths that there is a specific task that has to be done. With regard to the first Noble Truth, the Noble Truth of dukkha or suffering, what is the task to be done? Anybody remember it? Right. The noble truth of dukkha is to be parinyeya, to be fully understood. And so as we're practicing the path, what we have to do is to fully understand the noble truth of dukkha or suffering. And what this actually means is that one has to understand the five aggregates, which are a kind of epitome of, or the essence of dukkha, the essence of the First Noble Truth. So one has to understand the five aggregates by understanding what is the specific nature of each of these five aggregates. What is the specific nature of matter or physical form? What is the nature of feeling? What is the nature of perception? What is the nature of the volitional activities? What is the specific nature of consciousness? And then when one defines the specific nature, then one has to be able to observe it in one's experience. So this is actually what the practice of vipassana, insight meditation, is about. One has to be able to distinguish the nature of, sometimes it's expressed as the nature of the five aggregates, the nature of nama-rupa, name and form, by being able to identify the specific characteristic of each of these aspects of experience. And so when one is doing the practice of insight, one is looking into the nature of one's experience by seeing how experience is a constellation, or a you could say it's a process involving five constituents or five aspects: the physical or material aspect, contributed by the body, by the sense faculties, and then the psychological aspect contributed by the feeling tone, the perceptual activity, the volitional activity, and the underlying awareness of all this, which is consciousness. And then one moves from the specific characteristics to the general characteristics, to those characteristics that characterize all the elements or constituents of experience. And what are those general characteristics? The Buddha always expresses them in terms of the three marks of existence.
Anicca, anatta, and dukkha.
Okay, but in the usual order, it's anicca, which is impermanence, that everything involved in experience arises and passes away, so it's impermanent. And because it's impermanent, it's dukkha, which here doesn't mean that it's all suffering, but it's all, you could say, defective, not worth holding on to, not worth clinging to, unsatisfactory. And then it's all, because it's impermanent, unsatisfactory, so it's not to be taken as self, not to be grasped and held to and identified with as I and mine. So those are the three universal marks of all phenomena. So that is the full understanding of the truth of dukkha. Okay, then, with respect to the second noble truth, the truth of the origination of dukkha, there is a particular function, particular task. What is that task?
It's also to be fully understood.
No, it has its own distinct task or function.
It's to be abandoned?
Exactly. It's to be abandoned. So one has to eliminate, overcome, or abandon the noble truth of the origin actually is referring to craving. And so craving is to be abandoned, to be eliminated. Craving, and then along with craving there come a whole bundle of defilements. So all of those defilements have to be eliminated. And the third noble truth is the cessation of dukkha, which really means nibbana. And what is the particular objective or task regarding this truth? Don't look out the window. I heard the word. Who said it? Suki. Say it more loudly.
Should be realized.
Right, it's to be realized. Not just in the sense of being known, but to be experienced. Okay, so nibbana is to be realized, to be experienced. And then the fourth noble truth is the truth of the path. And what is the function with regard to that truth? Yeah, but there's a more specific word that we use, more precise word.
It's to be developed.
To be
developed?
Yeah, to be developed, to be cultivated. And so we have four tasks one regarding each of the Noble Truths. And while we are on the path, then we have to perform those tasks. You could say that those are the objectives of in the real life of a committed follower of the Buddha, of the Buddha's path. But then when one reaches the end of the path, the attainment of arhatship, then the arhat says what had to be done, fully understanding the first truth, abandoning craving, realizing nirvana, developing the path, those tasks have been done. And so then you can say that there's nothing more. That there's nothing more to be done. Okay, then comes the fourth part of the declaration, that there is, here it's expressed, that there is no more coming to any state of being. It's actually a little bit cryptic in the Pali, na param ita tayati, that there's no more for thisness. That's a very literal translation. Okay, so the Buddha is saying that here a monk comes and he makes this declaration of final knowledge. Now normally if somebody is speaking truthfully, one would want to congratulate him, applaud him, and to rejoice in his attainment. But the Buddha doesn't encourage that at once, but he says, you have to be careful. He says, this monk's words should neither be approved nor disapproved. Without approving or disapproving, a question should be put to him thus. Okay, then we're going to come to ways of questioning the monk. And why does one question the monk? Why doesn't one just applaud him and congratulate him?
Is it to confirm that he is truly attained what he says he has?
Yeah, because he could be either deluded about his attainment, he could have had maybe like just a very powerful experience in meditation, and then he thinks, that's it, that's the full realization, I'm an arhat. Or he could be, in the worst case scenario, sort of boasting, or let's say, falsely boasting in order to boost up his prestige. I mean, I know cases, I've had experience with both cases in Sri Lanka. Yeah, I remember there was a young American monk, this was, could have been the year 1996, 97, something like that. Some young American monk who we thought was rather strange in his behavior. One day I was sitting out on there was a stone bench in front of a cottage where I was living, and I was sitting out there in the late afternoon meditating, and then this young American monk that I hadn't seen for months, he comes walking down the path, he comes walking up to me, and he looked like a mess. I mean, the robe was all disheveled, his hair was sort of, whiskers were growing, unshaved from the head, body all dirty. And he came up to me and he said, how many verses are there in the Theragatha? The Theragatha is the collection of the verses that were declared by the direct disciples of the Buddha and from the early generations, the monks who became arahats. So I didn't remember the exact number, so I said, gee, I don't remember the exact number, maybe it's somewhere around 500 or 600. Then he said to me, well, we can add two more verses to the collection. And he said, can I stay here tonight? I said, since it's the late afternoon, I'll let you stay here one night. The next day you go. And then there was another monk who, he didn't declare arahatship, but he would speak about giving meditation courses, and he would say, well, we had quite a successful meditation course. There were about five of the people became stream enterers, and about three of them became once returners, and there were a couple of non-returners. So, you know, when he's making judgments like that about the students, then one has to infer, where are you? And he turned out to be like a real troublemaker also. You know, so when people make these declarations, one has to be very careful about where they're coming from mentally. Okay, so here the Buddha is saying that when a monk makes this declaration, you should neither approve, you know, by congratulating and saying, yes, wonderful, you've done it, nor should you immediately disapprove and say, no, you couldn't have done it. No, it's something for, you know, people were able to attain that in the early days of the Buddha's teaching, but now, you know, this is the last time the teaching is becoming degenerate. You couldn't have achieved this. But rather, you should put a question to the monk thus. And here, I have to say that this, the Pali version of the sutta begins in a rather strange way, because we find here the Buddha says that this is the way you should question the monk. He says, you should ask him or say to him, there are these four kinds of expression rightly proclaimed by the Blessed One, the Buddha, the one who knows and sees. What are the four? Then one speaks of the seen as it was seen. One speaks of the heard as it was heard. One speaks of the sensed as it was sensed. One speaks of the cognized as it was cognized. The reason I say that this is a rather strange way to begin is that one doesn't find these, what's called these four modes of expression, four kinds of expression, very often in the suttas. They're mentioned occasionally, but it's not such a common theme. And so it seems a bit odd that the first way of questioning the monk would be in terms of these four modes of expression. And I checked, there is a counterpart to the sutta in the Chinese counterpart of the Majjhima Nikaya, the Madhyamaka Agama. This would be Madhyaka Agama number 187. And in that sutta, it's very similar to the Pali version, except that the questioning begins in terms of the five aggregates, which is a much more common formula in the suttas. Okay, but since the Pali version, since we're explaining the Pali version, we'll take it in terms of these four modes of expression. And so the four modes of expression revolve around four ways of, say, analyzing or classifying the objects of experience. So we have the first two are quite obvious. The first two are what is seen and what is heard. So those are the objects of the visual consciousness and of hearing consciousness or ear consciousness. And the fourth one in Pali is called mutta. Let's just skip over this and take the fourth one is vinyata, which is based on the verb vijanati. So this would be what is cognized, what is known by the mind, independent of the senses. In other words, it's the objects of conceptualization, introspection, mental reflection, imagination, judgment. So whatever is known inwardly, that is the cognized. And then the word mutta originally meant thought. What is thought? As a past participle, not as a noun. But if the word thought is very close to cognized, and so the way the commentaries explain mutta, in order to fully encompass all the objects of experience, they explain mutta as meaning what is sense. But we already have the seen and the heard, so what is sensed by, say, by smelling, taste, and touch. And so in this way, the seen, heard, mutta, and cognized becomes a way of expressing all the objects of experience, all of the six types of objects, the five sense objects and the objects of inner cognition, the objects of reflection. And so one who declares final knowledge should be able to correctly declare these four modes of expression, four types of objects. And again, it's a little strange that the Pali version of the sutta just says that one speaks of the seen, the seen as seen, the heard as heard, and so on. But in the Chinese version, it says that regarding each of these, one is not attached to it, not repelled by it, not dependent upon it, not bound by it, not fettered or attached to it. And that seems to me to be a more complete exposition. Because otherwise it's a little puzzling. What is meant just I mean, you could ask anybody what are, you know, the seen, heard, sensed, and cognized, and they can explain correctly. But to be an arhat, it would have to mean that in regard to all the objects of the senses, one doesn't have any attachment through craving or any repulsion through aversion. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh. I jumped to a wrong conclusion because the Pali actually is exactly the same as I. Okay, the arhat here says rewind, delete. What do they call this in the film industry? Cut and take two, is that how it goes? Okay, so he answers that those are the four types of expression, but then one asks him, how does the Venerable One know, how does he see regarding these four kinds of expressions, so that through not clinging, his mind is liberated from the taints? Okay, so then the Buddha goes on and says that when the monk is an arhat, that is one whose taints are destroyed, who has lived the holy life, this is the natural way for him to answer. Then he goes on and he says, friends, regarding the seen, I dwell unattracted, unrepelled, independent, detached, free, dissociated in the sense of, again, not bound or dependent on them, with a mind rid of barriers. Okay, so basically what he's showing here is that the arhat is free from, because he's unattracted, that means that there's no lust, craving, or attachment in him. And because he's unrepelled, that means that there's no hatred, ill will, aversion in him. And because he's independent, detached, free, dissociated, and so on, that would imply, I guess, the absence of all of the defilements. And then the same is said regarding the heard, sensed, and cognized. And so he'll say, it's by knowing thus and seeing thus that regarding these four kinds of expressions, or actually I would say now these four objects of expression, that my mind is liberated from the taints through not clinging. Okay, any questions at this point? Anything covered so far? Okay, then we'll go on. Okay, so now the Buddha is explaining how the monks would respond, that when the monk who declares final knowledge answers in this way, then one can say good. In Pali, this would be sadhu. So one says sadhu. But again, one doesn't stop with the questioning, but one might want to question him further. And so then the Buddha explains how one should go on and question him. So one says that there are these five aggregates which are subject to clinging. rightly proclaimed by the Blessed One, by the Buddha. So what are the five aggregates? So then the one who's questioning will spell them out. He says, we've already gone through them. They are the form aggregate or material substance, the substance of the body, the sense faculties. Then there's the feeling aggregate, perception aggregate. Then here we have it as formations, but now I prefer volitional activities, volitional formations, and consciousness. And so within any experience, we have these five aspects. Sometimes people speak about them as being the five components of existence, but I don't find that way of explanation completely satisfactory, because it's not like, you know, in fact, I don't particularly like the simile of the chariot or the simile of the car, because with a car, you can take the steering wheel, the seats, the engine, the chassis, the body, put them together and you have a car, but you can take them apart and you still have a steering wheel, seats, the engine, the chassis, the body. It's just that they're not joined together in a car. But in the case of the five aggregates, you can take apart, you know, the body, put over here, feeling, take that apart, put it over here, perception, put it over there, volitions over here, and consciousness over there. If you try to take the five aggregates apart, you don't have any of them, they all disappear. So instead of seeing them as five parts or components of a person or a living being, rather see them as five aspects of experience, which are always essentially functioning together. So experience sort of occurs as a unified whole, but when we look into experience, we can observe it from different points of view. So of course we need a physical, at least in the human world, we need a physical basis for experience. That is the living body. And we need, of course, for experience through any of the senses, we need the appropriate sense faculty. Eye, ear, body. Eye, ear, nose, tongue, and the sensitive body. But then we can look at the experience from the perspective, is it pleasant? Is it painful? Is it neither pleasant nor painful? So now we are looking at it from the perspective of the feeling. And then we can look at it in terms of the activity of what kind of object is it focusing on? And what are the aspects of the object that it's focusing on? When we look at the experience from that point of view, then we are investigating perception. Because the function of perception is to select the object, to home in on the object, to select the distinguishing features of the object, and then to sort of identify its object based upon the features that it selects. Okay, and then let me just finish the five, then you could ask the question. Okay, now always going along with experience, there is some type of volitional activity, even at the most basic level. Sometimes people think volitional activity means one is reacting or responding to the object. But even when we're just simply trying to be aware of something in front of us. For example, if I see somebody in the distance coming and I'm trying to see who is that person coming, then there's some volition involved in trying to distinguish who is that person. It's perception that's doing the distinguishing, the observing of that form coming towards me. But there's some effort to see and to distinguish. That would be the work of volition in a simple perceptual experience. But the most important aspect of volition is the way we respond or react to the basic sensory input. And that those responses will often be in terms of when we like something, trying to acquire it for ourselves, trying to take possession. So that would be volition working under the dominance of craving or clinging. And on the other hand, there'll be volitions which are governed by, when we don't like something, volitions governed by aversion. For example, when we get angry, when we try to hurt somebody, when we try to harm somebody, when one engages in angry speech, trying to inflict physical injuries, trying to slander somebody, all of that would be volitional activity driven by aversion. And so there'll be many different types of volitional activity. And then also there'll be good or wholesome volitional activities, volitional activities which are motivated by kindness, compassion, generosity, by the urge to understand, by wisdom, by patience, by humility. So all of those are different types of volitional activity. And then any experience, of course, is to some degree a conscious experience. So there'll be awareness which has arisen based on one or another of the sense faculties. So that is the aspect of consciousness. And so in that way, these five aggregates always flow together and function together as a kind of integrated whole.
You went? I was just trying to understand the distinction between sensation and perception. It's always confused.
Yeah. I actually don't particularly like the word sensation for Vedana. Vedana is what I translate as feeling, but even the word feeling has its inadequacy, because feeling in English will suggest emotion. But Vedana, the reason I don't like the word sensation is because the word sensation, at least to me, always suggests something that one is experiencing in the body. It can be maybe a sensation of cold, or a sensation of heat, or a sensation of tingling sensation, or a sensation of stiffness. Whereas Vedana signifies, I call it the felt tone of experience, as being either pleasant, painful, or neither, neutral feeling. And so experience that occurs through the eye, if I see something, I can feel pleasure, I can feel pain because of what I see. But that would be different from if I have eye strain, then I would say that is a sensation in the eye, that sensation of a strain in the eye. But just if I see, say an abstract expressionist painting and I don't like that style of art, then I might get an unpleasant feeling from seeing it. But it's not a sensation. the way I understand the word sensation. Okay, and perception and contrast is what sort of identifies objects based on their distinctive characteristics and features. So when you meet a person for the first time, the mind will naturally select like certain features, even spontaneously. Someone sees this person, then the mind will sort of select certain features of the person's face, of posture, and so on. So then if you meet that person on a later occasion, immediately the mind will fix on those features, and then one can identify that person again. Okay, any other questions?
Is it mentioned in the sutta at all that only an arhat can recognize an arhat?
I don't think that is said. I don't know whether that is true or not. It's possible that somebody at a lower level of attainment could have the ability to search the mind of somebody directly and know that there are no defilements in his mind.
I don't know about pain.
Excuse me?
Pain.
Yeah. I think that question is a little bit off track. I want to keep sort of on the track of the sutta itself.
I have a question about Vedana.
Yeah.
Is it possible to have a neutral feeling tone, or is it simply ignorance that
no,
is
no,
not seen?
No, it's possible to have a neutral feeling tone. I think if you just look at our experience throughout the day, there are innumerable occasions when we're having neutral feeling. You know, if one is just like walking down the road, pondering something, you know, you're not feeling a special pleasure, not special pain.
But isn't that like ignoring what's going on? You're in your thoughts, you're pondering, as opposed to not really having a pleasant or unpleasant response to what's around you?
Not necessarily. I mean, one could even be walking down the street being mindful, in which case, you know, one is aware of what is happening. But if it's just the ordinary act of walking, and you're not stubbing your toe, or you're not seeing something which is especially pleasant or beautiful, then it's just, most of the time, it's just neutral feeling going on.
I often think about this because if I think that I have a neutral feeling tone, I'm not sure if that's true, that I'm simply overlooking whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, or if it's truly neutral.
I think not necessarily. Though often if one sort of tunes in more precisely to the experience, one will see that the tone of experience that one might take to be neutral is actually subtly either painful or pleasant. But there are many, many occasions when there's actually a neutral feeling.
Okay, thank you very much.
Excuse me? Well, I thought that I explained it, but I'll just sort of briefly recapitulate. It's, let us say, it's the effort or the exertion to accomplish something. And so at the simplest level, in a simple perceptual experience, will be the exertion involved in, you know, simply trying to know the object. But then when we know the object, when we respond to it, it can be the effort to, if there's attachment, to acquire the object, to possess it, the volition to harm a person, for example, that's a kind of volition, the exertion to accomplish something, say if you're writing something, like a letter or an email, a piece of like an essay, the effort to complete it, doing some work, the effort to accomplish one's work, All of those activities are expressions of volition. Okay, let us move.
Vedana is the phantom of experience. It's karmically resultant, so that whether one feels as experience as pleasant or painful is predetermined.
You're asking whether all feeling is determined by previous karma. Is that it?
Yeah, because it's. But explain it as felt tone.
The felt tone.
Right.
It certainly doesn't mean that all feeling is the result of previous karma. That's a position that the Buddha expressly rejects. I mean, some of the feelings will be the result of past karma maturing, but probably most of the feelings that we undergo in the course of the day are not the result of karma. But they are the feelings which are generated by present activity. Okay, but I want to move on. Okay, so now having briefly enumerated the five aggregates, now the Buddha says that when a monk is one who is liberated through final knowledge, this is the natural way for him to answer. So this is one way that he might answer. There are a variety of ways for him to answer. But the way given here is, having known material form to be feeble, fading away, and comfortless, with the destruction, fading away, cessation, giving up, and relinquishing of attraction and clinging regarding material form, of mental standpoints, adherences, and underlying tendencies regarding material form, I have understood that my mind is liberated. Now this is a pretty dense little statement here, so we have to sort of unpack it to see what's involved. Here, the first descriptive word that's given is here, it's translated feeble. In Pali, it's ubala, which means without power or strength. If you look at this is a little interesting side point. If you look at the Chinese translation, where this word should come, the Chinese translation has wu guo. Wu guo means without fruit. And I was wondering, how is that? How do they ever get that rendering for without strength? Then I realized what happened. Probably in the transmission of the text, is that umbala somehow got misrepresented as upala. And the word pala means fruit. But I think umbala without feeble or without power is better, more accurate. Because what is meant is that because it's impermanent, so it has no power or strength to remain, you know, permanently, no substance. But what we call material form, when one looks at it with the eye of, you know, very precise inside observation, one sees that it's constantly breaking up, dissolving, and perishing. And so it doesn't have this intrinsic power or strength to persist in being. Well, even with regard to, you could take even the sense faculties, material sense faculties, as an example of ubala, without power, without strength. Like, you know, now, I just realized this, but I looked at the text, and all I saw was a blurry lines, and then had to reach for my glasses to read it. So my eyes are ubala, without strength. And I think now my hearing is still fairly good, but maybe a few more years I'll have to put on a hearing aid, because the ear will be without strength. And then maybe when I get to be really old, then have to use a walking stick. Of course, the body itself will be without strength. Okay, so it's feeble, fading away. This is, the word is viraga, which sometimes means dispassion, but that doesn't actually apply to the five aggregates, but rather raga, the word raga, originally means or meant color. And so viraga means losing its color. It's like a cloth or a piece of article of clothing. When you've washed it over and over, then maybe it was bright red when you started, but in time, especially in ancient India, when they would use not the chemical dyes like we use today, but natural dyes, so when clothes get washed over and over, then they be rudgety, they fade away, the dye comes out from them. And so this can apply metaphorically to all of the aggregates, that each of them fades away, even when one perceives them at subtler and subtler levels, even from 1 second to the next, they're fading away or disappearing. And so for this reason, they're said to be, I think this is anasasika, which means comfortless, that they're sort of not a basis of complete security. If we cling to them, hoping to find full security, perfect security in them, then the body falls away, feelings, we get painful feelings, we get disagreeable perceptions. Sometimes our mind gets out of control, so we have no control of our volition. So all of the five aggregates are sort of subject to misery and to some kind of suffering. So they're comfortless. So having known the five aggregates in this way, then one gives up and relinquishes attraction and clinging to them. Actually, attraction and clinging, these are just two aspects of attachment. And then comes the mental standpoints. The mental standpoints would be the standpoints from which one regards the five aggregates to be I, mine, and myself. So through these mental standpoints, one looks at the body as being mine, feeling as mine, perceptions as mine, volitions as mine, consciousness as mine. Or we take the five aggregates collectively to be a solid, substantial I. And then based on this notion, these notions of I and mine, then we build up conceptions of ourself. You know, what am I really like? What is my true self? And this seems to have been like a particular weakness in India during the Buddha's time, where the philosophers and the contemplatives of the period were building up many different theories about the true nature of the self. The self is infinite, self is finite, the self is eternal, the self is perishable, the self is essentially blissful, the self experiences bliss and misery, and so on. So many different theories of the self. And even in Western philosophy, we have, you know, Cartesian theory of the self, Leibnizian, idealist, empiricist, different theories of the self. And so these are different standpoints. All the Buddha will say is based on misunderstandings or misconceptions relating to the five aggregates. Okay, so we have mental standpoints, adherences, basically very similar to attachment and clinging, and then come the underlying tendencies. These would be the underlying tendencies. Sometimes the text mentions three underlying tendencies, which are the tendencies to attachment, to aversion, and to ignorance. And so in the case of the arahat, he's one who's relinquished all of these, this attraction and clinging, the mental standpoints, adherences, and underlying tendencies regarding the five aggregates. Any questions now about this part of the discourse?
Pante, you just said underlying tendencies to attachment, aversion. What was the third?
Ignorance.
Thank you.
Yeah, in other suttas, seven underlying tendencies are mentioned. I have to see if I can remember them all. I think one then becomes sensual desire, then comes attachment to continued existence, views, doubt, conceit, ignorance. That's six. I said views, right? Anybody remember the seventh? Kamaraga, Patiga, Pavaraga, Titi. I think doubt is one. Did I say doubt? I think doubt is the seventh. Let me cheat. The underlying tendency to lust, to aversion, to doubt, to conceit. Then comes the desire for being, or this is, I call this now, the craving for individual existence, and the underlying tendency to ignorance. So those are the seven. Any further questions? Okay, then let us go on to the next section. Okay, so again, now we're in section 7. So again, the Buddha says that when a monk speaks in this way, one may delight and rejoice in his words, but now one should question him further. And now the question is going to be posed in terms of what are called the six elements. So one says that there are these six elements rightly proclaimed by the Bhagavad, the Blessed One, the Buddha. What are the six? They are the earth element, the water element, the fire element, the air element, the space element, and the consciousness element. So you see, the Buddha has, or he proposes, different ways of looking at the totality of experience. The most common scheme, of course, that we come across is the five aggregates, in which when we take the five aggregates, we can see that there's a preponderance or a distress or emphasis is upon dissecting the mental side of experience. And all of the material side of existence is grouped together under just the one aggregate of rupa, material form. But with the scheme of the six elements, now we're dissecting or analyzing more thoroughly the material side of experience, and the whole mental side of experience is just sort of grouped under the heading of consciousness. And so here we have four primary elements. The four primary elements are, they're called, we use these conventional terms, earth, water, fire, and air. Those were the terms that we used, you know, for generations before the time of the Buddha, you know, maybe going back to the Vedas, the Brahmanas, the Upanishads. And so the Buddha took over this terminology. But the way the Buddhist tradition understands the four primary elements, it's not like just, you know, the ground, bodies of water, fire, and the air, but rather these are taken to be, I call them, four behavioral modes of any kind of material substance. So in any material substance, we have the aspect, some aspect of solidity or resistance to pressure, or you could call it substance, some aspect of substance. So we can, through the sense of touch, we experience this as being different degrees of hardness, softness, and so on. So even if one takes a cup of water, so it seems to be, you might think it's an example of the water element, but even in that cup of water, if we compress it very, very hard, it'll turn to ice. Or if we compress it, come a point of maximum resistance where we can't press anymore. That's because there's the presence of the earth element there, which is resisting the pressure. And so even water has the earth element. Let me just go through the four elements. So the earth element is the aspect of, I call it, material substance, the aspect of solidity, the aspect of resistance to pressure. Then the water element is explained to be that aspect of matter which is responsible for cohesion, for the binding together of the particles of matter. I think the way the ancient Indians came to identify the water element with the aspect of cohesion is that they would observe, because they have experience making what they call rotis, or they call chapati, you know, chapati. Maybe this would be like our pancakes. This is the flatbread. When you put the powder or the flour on the board, the rolling board, when it's dry and a wind blows, it will scatter the flour. There's nothing is holding the flour together. But then when you sprinkle water on it, then knead it together, then it forms a kind of paste, the dough, and then you roll the dough on the board and it forms the, well, you have to shape it to be round, but all of the dough will hold together. And so it seems that it's the water element which is enabling the pieces of flour, the particles of flour, to bind together. Okay, then what's called the fire element is the aspect of heat by which any material body has some degree of heat. Even if we go below zero, 100 degrees below zero, as long as we're above absolute zero, then there's some degree of heat in the body. That is the presence of the fire element. And then what's called the air element or the wind element is the aspect of oscillation or vibration, the aspect of movement. And so all material, all matter in the perspective of the of Holy Buddhism is seen to be in some way in motion. So even when we have this lid on the table at some degree is very subtle level, it's vibrating, moving back and forth. The particles within this lid, the molecules and atoms are moving around, moving back and forth. And of course we see the air element most obviously within the in and out breathing, but it's also said to be working through all of the cells of the body. Okay, so in any kind of matter, we have these four elements. The element, the earth element, is what provides the sort of substance, the substance of the particles of matter. The water element is the force of binding a cohesion. The heat element is the degree, or the fire element is the degree of heat within any kind of material body. And the air element is what is responsible for movement, vibration, oscillation. And in the space element here, usually it's taken not to be what we call the all-embracing space, but it's taken to be the space in the sense of the emptiness between the particles of matter. Not emptiness in the sense of sunyata, you know, the philosophical sense, but just the empty where there's space not occupied by any kind of material body. That is the space element. And then it seems here that the conscious element, consciousness element, has to be understood in a very broad way as amongst the five aggregates, not just the aspect of consciousness, but also as including, along with it, feeling, perception, and volitions. Otherwise, we don't have a complete scheme. Okay, so then the Buddha says that the monk should ask the one declaring arhatship, how have you known, how have you seen regarding these six elements? And the monk who's declaring arhatship should declare, it uses the expression, I have treated the earth element as not self, with no self based on the earth element. I think the word treated, I think this must come from Venerable Nyanamoli. If I remember, the Pali word is upagacchati, which means approached. But I think we could use the word regarded would work as well, maybe more naturally in English. So I have regarded the earth element as not self and no self based on the earth element. And so now one is focusing upon the six elements entirely by way of the characteristic of not self. And then through this insight, he says, with the destruction fading away, cessation giving up and relinquishing of attraction and clinging based on the earth element, again the destruction giving up of mental standpoints, adherences and underlying tendencies based on the earth element, I have understood that my mind is liberated. And then the same is said with regard to all of the other elements. Okay, any questions on this section? Please. What is your name?
Daniel. Can you just expand upon the precise definition of what it means by attraction and clinging based on each of the elements, like how that's associated with the elements as opposed to other things?
Yeah, actually that's a good question. The question is how to expand on the meaning of attraction and repulsion in regard to each of the elements. Because normally it seems we don't, you know, focus in on the elements individually and become attracted and repelled by them. In fact, maybe this passage has to be taken not exactly literally, but we sort of have to extrapolate from it. Because usually I think what happens is that attraction and repulsion are based upon the perception of the physical body as a whole. You know, so usually, say, you know, the man sees a lovely, pretty girl, then he becomes attracted to the pretty girl. The young girl sees a handsome man, becomes attracted to the man, or just on elsewise on physical appearances, people like each other, dislike each other, because they're sometimes focusing upon the body as a whole. But now I think the approach that one would use would be to analyze the body, if one wants to gain detachment from it, in terms of the material elements. And so, okay, suppose that I'm angry with a person, and so I have some kind of resentment against that person. Whenever I see that person, I get upset, angry, don't like the person. If I'm in the room, that person comes into the room, then I get upset and I feel the impulse to get up and walk out. Okay, but now, in order to dispel that repulsion, what I do is, you know, take this person and say, what is it that I'm actually angry with? Then I look, okay, there's this being that I identify with the person, but what is really there? When that person comes into the room, there's the earth element. The earth element is just, if we look at in terms of the physical body, it will be what's prominent in, for example, in the muscles, the bones, the tissues, the organs, the heart, the liver, stomach, lungs, the liver, intestines, the muscles of the legs, the shins, bones of the legs and feet. Can I be angry with a bunch of tissue and bones? No. And then One could take the water element. So the water element, most prominent in the blood, the sweat, the oils of the body, the lymph, the inner fluids. Do I get angry or attracted to the fluids of the body? No. Okay, when the person comes in, he brings in, you know, a degree of heat, 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit heat. Do I get angry with the heat? No. And then the person is the air element, most obvious in the breathing in and out. Do I get angry with his breathing in and out? No. And then, of course, there'll be the spaces that that person brings in, the empty space in the lungs, in the stomach, the very small spaces within the head, the nostrils, the mouth. Do I get angry with that? No. And then there's the consciousness element. Of course, maybe some features of his character I don't like, but if we just, you know, dissect the character down into his feelings, his perceptions, his volitions, his consciousness, then I don't get angry with those. And so in that way I dispel the anger based on the perception of the person. So it's really my perception of the person that causes the anger to arise. But when we get beyond this sort of deluded perception and look at the person as, you know, constituted by the six elements, and then when we see the person in terms of the six elements, then we see that there's no substantial self there, but it's just the coming together of these six elements. And so then the sort of anger has no foundation upon which to rest. It sort of just dissipates into air.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll take one question, then we'll have to break for the lunch.
What we discussed, what you were referring to, Devante, is theoretically correct. And we all...
But take the microphone so we'll get you.
We all try to practice it, but knowing it and practicing it does not mean that you are enlightened, though, isn't it?
That is actually true. That's a good point. That just knowing this, sort of knowing it conceptually, but theoretically, doesn't mean that one is enlightened. I mean, this is a very true point. So I guess one would have to say that being able to answer correctly is not really sufficient as a mark of attainment. In fact, this is what, you know, through the centuries always creates the problem with certifying the attainments of others, or even certifying one's own attainment, because one could have some very powerful, dramatic, maybe meditative experience, and then one knows these things theoretically, and so one starts interpreting one's experience in terms of these principles, and then one could jump prematurely to the conclusion, therefore I'm enlightened. You know, even in Zen Buddhism, where they have these sort of incomprehensible puzzles, like the sound of one hand clapping, jumping off the foot of a 100-foot pole without getting hurt. I think there are books of answers to that. So if you want to get certified as having the Zen enlightenment, you know, you get the book and you read the answers. So then when the Zen master asks you that difficult question, you can come up with the right answer. Okay, we'll stop and then we'll come back 12:15. Or maybe because we have to walk a little ways down. We'll see, 12:30 maybe we'll start. We'll have about 20-minute question and answer. Okay. We end with the sharing of the merits. Okay, so we're going to share the merits with the devas, that's the deities, the nagas, the dragon spirits, the buddhas, the fair spirits, asking them to rejoice in the merits, to protect the world, to protect the Dharma, the teaching, to protect ourselves and others. Akasata chalumata deva naga mahidika punyantam anumodipa chiram rakantu sasanam. Akasata chalumata deva naga mahidika punyantam anumodipa chiram rakantu desanam. Akasata chalumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumodipa chiram rakantu mam param. Eta vatajam hei sampadam punya sampadam sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya bhavagupadaya vichye tato etantare satakayupapana rupya rupicha sanya sanyino dukha pamuchantu pusantu nipotin. Okay, before we leave, I just have a few announcements. Okay, one announcement. You might know that Zhuangyan Monastery is maintained by an organization called BAUS, B-A-U-S, the Buddhist Association of the United States. And next month, the weekend of May 24th and 25th, BAUS will be celebrating its 50th anniversary. And now, of course, everybody's invited, but there's a need for volunteers, various tasks to be performed during that celebration. And so if anybody was interested in volunteering, who should they contact? You?
Yeah.
Or they can go to the office?
Yeah.
Who should they speak to in the office?
The reception.
This would be Yoko or...
Yeah. Yoko. Wen. Sure. Wen. Wan Mei.
Wen. Yeah, you can just go to the office and you'll see one woman that right to the left when you go in is... Angmei.
Yeah.
That's her name.
Yeah.
Wangmei. And or Yoko, who's on the further desk. And you just give your contact information. And really, if you're free that weekend and you would like to volunteer, we really do need help. Another announcement. We've been speaking about being not attracted, not repelled, but you know, we have an organization called Buddhist Global Relief, and later this month, we're having a concert to feed the hungry. This will be a jazz concert featuring some world-renowned jazz artists. One is Esperanza Spalding and Kenny Werner. And this concert will be on April 25th. In New York City, the Interchurch Center. There are these, you know, like postcards here for, you have to register online for to acquire tickets, or you can call, I think, for tickets, or write. But I'm going to leave these cards on the table here. So if you're interested, you pick up a card. And was there something else that I had to announce? Oh, next weekend or next Friday, they're starting a meditation retreat here I think registration is still open. It's an 8-day retreat on the four divine abodes, loving kindness, compassion, altruistic joy, and equanimity. So if you're interested to participate, you can also go to the office to register for the retreat. We'll have a class next Saturday. I'm going to join the retreat, but I'll join Saturday afternoon because I don't want to cancel. I'm not going to have the class on the 19th because that will be the retreat. We'll be going fully, will be in full steam then. And I don't want to cancel two classes in a row. So we'll have a class next Saturday, but we won't have the class on the 19th. The class after that will be on the 26th. Okay, and then we come back here, as I said, in 12:30 for about 20 minutes, half an hour discussion, question and answers discussion. Okay, so thank you for your attention. And we end with three vows to the Buddha. Okay, one, two, three.
Follow the abundance. Okay.